Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You've heard the phrase, it's all in the timing. Turns out that research shows that literally when we do something can affect the outcome of that something. Best-selling author Daniel Pink took that idea to task in his new book titled When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Daniel Pink joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Daniel appears tonight at Bexley High School. For more information, you can visit the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. He'll also be at Gramercy Books later on tonight as well. Has working on this book changed how you time your life?
Absolutely.
Like
more than any other book that I've written, this book has had a big effect on my own life. Because you know, what I did is and it was actually the impetus of the whole book was my own life. I was making all kinds of timing decisions in my own life. When should I exercise? When should I do this kind of work? When should I do that kind of work? I was making them in a pretty haphazard way. That frustrated me. I started looking around for guidance. It didn't exist. Then I started looking at I said, there's got to be some research on this. I looked at the research, and there was a mountain of research across many, many disciplines that gives us clues about how to make better when decisions in our life. So,
what kinds of research?
Oh, my gosh. It's in so many different domains, and that's both part of the opportunity and the challenge.
Right.
So it's in economics. It's in social psychology, which is where I've done a fair amount of writing myself. But it's also in endocrinology, something I know nothing about, anesthesiology. Molecular biology. There's a whole field called chronobiology. There's cognitive science on this. And what's interesting is that this research is splattered across literally dozens of disciplines. And what's troubling about academics sometimes is that they don't talk to people outside of their discipline. But they're all asking the same questions. What's the effect of time of day on what we do and how we do it? How do beginnings affect us? How do midpoints affect us? How do endings affect us? How do groups synchronize in time? And if you go wide enough and deep enough into this research, as I've tried to do, you can find the evidence to make better decisions.
It starts about as far as the decisions we make with our daily patterns and that kind of a thing. You first ask your reader to determine your chronotype.
Right.
And that's a three-question method or by completing another questionnaire online, which I went to, but that questionnaire is off. So I went to another one. And it turns out I'm a moderate morning.
Okay.
And so it is personal. And that's why I asked you that first question first is how it's affected you personally, because this is very personal. It's not like there's guidelines and there's big categories of people and what they are, but it's still personal.
Sure. They're broad patterns, but it starts out with in order to figure out, especially for time of day, the right time to do something, it begins with that personal question, which is, what's your chronotype? Are you a morning person, an evening person, or in between? Are you a lark? About 15% of us are larks. Are you an owl? About 20% of us are owls. Most of us are like you and me in the middle, what I call a third bird.
And when I did my chronotype, it said, you're probably going to bed too early, which I thought was kind of interesting. It did sort of change me, and I stayed up later last night, and I actually did sleep better. So
really?
I don't know what it is, but what – how do we all live together if some of us are larks, some of us are owls, and the majority of us are in between? How do we do that? Because we know that, for instance, schools are very regimented according to everybody being a super lark.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the real problem on that are people who are the owls. All right. The people like us in the middle, the people like us in the people who are morning people, we tend to move through the day in a common pattern. Peak, trough, recovery. Morning, peak of mood, of analytic ability. Afternoon, trough. Later in the afternoon, recovery in mood, recovery in our creative abilities. That's about 80% of us. The real problem, the people who really get the short end of the stick, are the people who are owls, the 20% of us who go through the day in the reverse order. And in many ways, the corporate world and I think the education world is designed to crush the spirits of people who are owls. I mean, everything about it is antithetical to how they move through the day.
And then people are owls as teenagers,
but
they change. So we're not uniformly the same way over time.
There are big changes over age. Little kids tend to be very larky, as any parent will know. And then around 14 or 15, human beings begin this very pronounced move toward greater lateness, 2 hours, 3 hours sometimes, that continues until the mid-20s. This is one of the problems with starting school so early. Starting school early for these very owly teenagers is an incredibly bad idea. It is contraindicated by every piece of scientific and medical evidence we have.
And yet we continue to do it.
And yet we continue to do it because it's convenient for adults.
Right. You've said that people should put off certain work for certain times. And you start out the whole book with an example of the Lusitania.
Mm-hmm.
Which was interesting.
Sure, sure, sure. So you know, when we try to explain things, when we try to explain events, when we try to explain our own behavior, I think sometimes we don't default enough to the simplest explanation. So if you have the Lusitania, which is, you know, World War I, you have this British ship sailing from New York to the UK. World War I is in the air. The United States is trying to stay out of it. Great Britain is in the thick of it. There's a warning that the ship couldn't cross. And to make a long story short, this ship gets sunk by some German U-boats, German submarines.
Mm-hmm.
And there, for the last 70 years, there's been this blaze of speculation. Oh, was there some kind of conspiracy? Was they secretly trafficking arms? Did they actually self-sabotage in order to lure the United States into the war? And if you actually unpack this story through the lens of the modern science of timing, what you see is that you had a captain who made a couple of really bad decisions. And he made those really bad decisions at what we know is precisely the worst time of day to make an important decision.
What, 3 o'clock in the afternoon?
And he did it about 1:30 in the afternoon. And he did it after having been sleep deprived the night before. And so there could be a simpler human explanation. We love conspiracy theories. We love complicated chains of events to explain things. But sometimes it's as simple as that. And that's really the key to this kind of research, in that just take time of day alone. Time of day alone explains about 20% of the difference in how people perform on the job. And we tend to ignore that. We're very intentional about what we do. Your listeners, I'm sure, have a to-do list today. We're intentional about how we do it and who we do it with. But when it comes to questions of when we do things, we're not intentional. We don't care. We think it doesn't matter. And it does. When we do things plays a big, big role in how we feel, how we perform, what we accomplish. And we need to start taking it seriously and make decisions based on this evidence.
A lot of people have feelings about that already, particularly adults as they've engaged. They know that, gosh, I know that if I'm going to get the house cleaned, I better do it in the morning, or I clean house better in the middle of the night. I guess that would be an owl kind of a thing. So we have these sort of feelings about when we are, but then we negate them a lot.
That's precisely right. So sometimes these feelings, these intuitions are right. Sometimes they're wrong. But what we tend to do is we tend to override these things because we think that when we do something doesn't matter. But let's take healthcare as an example. Mm. All right. Let's go back to schools for a second. There's research out of Denmark showing that when kids take standardized tests, kids who take standardized tests in the afternoon score as if they've missed 2 weeks of school.
Mm.
That's a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We don't, and what happens is we say, oh, you got to take the test. It doesn't really matter when you take the test. Well, it does, because kids who are taking the test in the afternoon perform considerably worse. If you look at elementary school students, a massive study out of the LA Unified School District, elementary school students who take math in the morning score better, learn more than those who take tests in the afternoon. And yet, when we do school schedules, it's all about logistics, availability.
So there's this massive study out of LA Unified School District. Did they change their policies?
No.
Okay.
See, this is the extraordinary thing. We have this mountain of evidence showing this, and yet we're not taking these when questions seriously. The good news is that there are some. There are places that have done things to arrest some of this problem. So let's talk about healthcare for a second. I would not let anybody in my family go to the hospital or go to an important doctor's appointment in the afternoon. In the afternoon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there are four times as many anesthesia errors as are at 9 in the morning. We know that colonoscopies, doctors find half as many polyps in afternoon exams as they do in morning exams. We know that hand washing in hospitals decreases markedly in the afternoon. And so what do you do about that? Well, in the case of the hand washing, what they did is they gave nurses more breaks. When nurses had more breaks, hand washing went back up. In Denmark, they realized if you give these kids 20 to 30 minute breaks to run around a little bit before they take the standardized test, their scores go back up.
why is it that kids score better on morning tests than afternoon, but we're talking about the fact that kids are better off sleeping in the morning?
Depends on what – it depends on how old the kids are.
Okay.
So what we know is that in – and it also depends on what part of the morning. We know, for instance, that most of us, all right, let's leave out the 14 to 25 year olds who are strong owls for now. We know that most of us move through the day in this peak trough recovery period. During our peak, we're better off doing analytic work. That's true whether we're 8 years old or whether we're 48 years old. During our peak, we're better off doing analytic work. Analytic work is work that requires heads down, focus, attention, and energy. Locked down, writing a report, analyzing data. We're vigilant then, so we can bat away distractions. During our peak, where our vigilance is highest, that's when we should be doing our analytic work, no matter what age we are. During our trough, which we've talked about, this early to mid-afternoon period, that's not good for very much. So we should be doing more of our administrative kinds of things, answering routine emails, filling out stupid reports. Then during the recovery period, which is the late afternoon, our mood goes in early evening. Our mood goes back up, but we're less vigilant. That makes it a good time for creative kinds of work. And so what we should be doing is putting the right work at the right time in our schools, in our offices, in our personal lives.
Kids aren't – adolescents, teenagers aren't ready to learn. It's not their peak time at 8 o'clock in the morning, but it is for the teachers.
Yeah, that's
all
a great point.
Being equal.
Great point.
And there's a conflict there.
Yeah, and I think that there has to be some kind of synthesis or compromise from that. So what we're talking about, so let's talk about school start times. The schools that have changed their start times, and we're not talking about going crazy here. We're talking about starting school at 9:15 rather than at 7:30. And what the schools that have done that, even that modest change, which is a compromise, is they've seen lower dropout rates, higher test scores, less teen depression, fewer teen accidents. The problem with school start times for adolescents is so severe that the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2014 issued a policy statement saying, please do not start school for teenagers before 8:30 in the morning. This is America's pediatricians linking arms and announcing this. And yet the average school start time in America is 8:03, which means we're putting kids on buses at teenagers on buses at 7. The solution isn't to go crazy, and that's true for a lot of this time-based stuff. It's to make modest modifications. Start school at 9:15. The kids are going to be better. The teachers are going to still be in pretty good shape.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Daniel Pink. His new book is titled When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Daniel will be holding an author talk and book signing tonight at Bexley High School's Schottenstein Center. For more information, check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the importance of timing, something that took on a whole different meaning when I got into radio. We often ponder what we should do or how we should do something, ask for a raise, change jobs, get married, or have children. But when might be the more important factor? Still with us is best-selling author Daniel Pink. His new book is titled When? The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. If you have a question or a comment for Daniel Pink, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's talk about the idea of taking a break, because just talking to you, I know from meeting you, taking a break probably didn't come naturally to you.
It did not, and
you're kind of...
Yeah, well, here's the thing. So I had absorbed this very puritanical view of things where the way to get more done was not to take a break, that breaks were a concession. They were a sign of weakness, that in a puritanical way, they were that it was morally virtuous not to take a break. And that turns out to be wrong. Flatly wrong, flatly contraindicated by the science.
Very well embraced in the United States, by the way. It's like
lovingly,
a religion.
Lovingly embraced in a ginormous American bear hug here in the in the United States. And what the science is telling us is, I think, pretty similar. I think there's an analogy here. 15 years ago, someone who came into the office sleep deprived, who's pulled an all nighter, who you know, I've only gotten 3 hours of sleep every night for the last 6 weeks, was seen as a hero. Now, in the last 15 years, the science of sleep has deepened, and it's also hit the public consciousness. And so now we know that person is not a hero. He's a fool. It's always a he, too. That person's a fool. And that's because we understood the science both at the research level and at the popular level. I think that breaks are following that same pattern, that the science of breaks is telling us that powering through is not a good idea. There is no moral virtue in powering through. There's moral virtue in getting good work done. And the way to get good work done is to take more breaks and, this is equally important, certain kinds of breaks. The research tells us very clearly what kind of breaks are most restorative. And so I'm a sinner who has been saved, and I've started taking more breaks.
What kind of breaks are most helpful?
Oh, so we know there's a set of design principles for breaks based on the science that I think are pretty clear. One, we know that something is better than nothing. So even taking a 1 minute, 2 minute break is better than not taking a break at all. We know that moving is better than stationary. So we should be moving around. And I think people are familiar with the mountain of research there showing the importance of not sitting all day,
standing
not being
up
sedentary.
Once every hour, that kind of a thing. Yeah.
We know that outside is better than inside, that breaks in nature are especially restorative. Tough on a day like this, but still having that exposure to the outdoors is helpful. Interestingly, we know that social is better than solo, that breaks with somebody else are more restorative than breaks on your own. And this is true even for introverts. And then finally, and this might be the most important thing, we know that fully detached is better than semi-detached.
What does that mean?
What it means is this. So there's some research showing if you have people at work and you tell one group of people, take a break and be sure to talk about work. Another group, take a break and talk about anything but work.
Uh-huh.
The people who are not talking about work come back and do better work. Because they're detached. The same thing is true with phones. And so if there's sort of an ideal kind of break, it's take a 10-minute walk break outside with someone you like, leaving your phone behind, talking about something other than work. I mean, we're not talking about a return to a Spanish siesta here where you have 3.5 hours in the middle of the day to go home and eat paella and drink red wine and take a 90-minute snooze. We're talking about being more systematic in scheduling breaks and scheduling the right kinds of breaks.
How have our phones and our electronic devices affected all of this?
Well, I mean, I think that they have they've made it harder to take a break. They've made it harder to fully detach. So you have people who might be trying to attempt a break. So, oh, I'm going to go outside for a break. And they're outside. They're with somebody else. They're walking. But they have their nose in their Instagram feed. And that's not really a break.
I want to switch now to just what your occupation is in life, what one's occupation is in life, and how they might consider this research in terms of that. This is a morning show. We produce it. We air it live in the morning. If you're not a morning person, I'm going to suggest if you're not at least a moderate lark like me, it probably isn't a good fit.
It would probably be tough to work here. If you're getting in early, you're doing analytic work. If you think about the work that you do, Anne, and your team here, it's pretty analytical. You're doing things in real – you're doing things live, talking about big issues live. You're screening calls. You have to respond to the guests. Is the guest making sense? Is she not making sense? What other kinds of questions could I ask? Is that a good call to come in? That's a very analytic kind of job. And if you're not at your best at this time of day, it's probably not the best. It's probably not the best situation for you.
I wonder how much or people who counsel people on their jobs, on what to go into as a career, take that into account.
I don't know. If I had a guess, though, I would guess that they mentioned that somewhere between Never and almost never.
Right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the science of timing. My guest is bestselling author Daniel Pink. His new book is titled When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Linny in Galloway, you're on the air. Hi, Linny.
Hi, Anne. Hi, Daniel. Recently, my mother died, so I have to make some big decisions. I have a hard time making decisions on a regular basis. Now that I have to make big, important decisions, when do I make them? What time of day? What time of week? How far? How long after Mom has died? I have no idea.
Yeah, yeah. There's no perfect answer to that question. What we know about decision making, particularly on the most important decisions, is that in general, if you're a lark or in the middle, you're better off making those decisions early in the day and immediately after the break. That's when we're more likely to be a little bit more analytical about them and consider a wider array of options. When later in the day and far from breaks, we're more likely just to go to we often have a default decision when we make decisions, and we're less likely to challenge the default when we do it later in the day. So as an overall rule of thumb, early in the day and immediately after breaks.
With a fresh eye early in the day. Linny, thanks for that call. I remember someone once gave me advice when I was making a big job change or whether I would make the job change or not. They said, ask yourself the question the second you wake up in the morning and it'll come to you. And it did. It was really interesting how clarifying that was, just doing it first thing in the morning. 614-292-8513 if you have a question or comment for my guest, Daniel Pink. You've written that afternoons are the Bermuda triangles of our days, and that's that slump period or that. Why is that? What's happening to us?
It's hard to say. Actually, I don't think that scientists fully know. There's a big decline in vigilance. There's a big decline in mental alertness. There's an increase in fatigue. And why that is actually the case is I don't think anybody knows. There's actually a pretty good evolutionary reason for it, though. So if you think about the way that human beings evolved, and particularly our brains evolved, our brains did not evolve in a world of Twitter and Facebook. Our brains did not evolve in a world of hours and minutes. Our brains evolved when human beings were out on the savannah trying to escape a saber-toothed tiger, right? And so our brains are formed in that kind of environment. Now, in that kind of environment, you were very much exposed to the elements. And so people who were out and about in the midday sun probably died at a higher rate than people who didn't. The people who had this propensity to get a little sleepy in the midday, maybe took a snooze under a tree, therefore stayed alive and passed their genes into the next generation. So there's a plausible evolutionary reason for that. I don't think we can lock down the specific reason, but we can do something about it. We can recognize that our brain power is not at the same throughout the day, that we perform differently at different times of the day, that this one period of the day is not great for performance. So we should either steer around that or do affirmative things to improve our performance during that time. So let's take surgery, for instance. I write about going to the University of Michigan Medical Center and standing in on some surgeries happened to be in the early afternoon, right in this trough period. Well, what did these doctors do? They took a time out. They took a step back from the operating table. They went through a checklist. They were taking affirmative steps to restore their vigilance. As a practical matter, we can't say, oh, you know what? No one needs to do any work between 1 p.m. and 3:30 p.m. Our lives don't operate that way. Mm-hmm. So we have to be intentional about taking those vigilance breaks, or if we're first responders, if we are nurses, if we are doctors, and then taking these more restorative breaks if we're just folks trying to do good work on the job.
Charles in Springfield, you're on the air with Daniel Pink. Hi, Charles.
How you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yes, my situation is I'm a paint subcontractor, and what we started doing is we started working our people less hours. Instead of 8 hours, we started working like 6.5 to 7 hours. And we found out we were getting a lot better work out of them. My problem was that the big contractors that I work for would be offended to see my people packing up and going home at 3 instead of 3:30 or 4. And I wanted to see his opinion on how he thinks that works. It worked well for us, but like I said, my problem was the big contractors were complaining about it.
Interesting.
And I'll listen to the reply on air.
All right. Thank you, Charles. Good question.
Yeah, Charles, that's a great question. I think that what Charles did there is actually a really important lesson at the outset. And there are not always perfect, simple, universal answers to all of these questions about when we should do what we should do. So there's some general guidelines. And what we should do is we should test things. Just like Charles tested, let's work for 6.5 hours versus 8 hours. He found that that worked better. All right, that's what we should be doing. We should be testing those kinds of things. So he tested it. It seemed like it worked. Now, how do you make the case to other people? I think it's a slow process. But what Charles and others have to do is make the case based on the results. Make the case not based on the inputs, but on the results. What does that contractor ultimately want? That contractor wants a building, the walls of a building, the walls of a home painted really, really well. It shouldn't matter to that contractor whether the painter herself left at 3 or 3:30. And so learning is really hard. Unlearning is even harder. Mm. But one of the things that the Charleses of the world – Charles is a great role model on this front. He's experimenting. He's trying new methods. He's finding what works. Now he has to take on the education role of educating customers, general contractors, and everyone else that what we should be focusing on is output rather than input.
Hmm. Brock and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Brock. Hello, Brock.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, so my question was, I remember earlier in the talk, Daniel had mentioned that there's the peak where analytical thoughts are better, there's the trough, and then there's the recovery. And he had mentioned that you're still alert, but maybe more of the creative processes should happen at that time of day. My question was, when would tackling emotional thoughts and decisions, does that happen in the analytical phase, or does that happen in the more creative phase?
It's an interesting question, too.
It's a really interesting question, and actually I'm not sure. I think it's going to depend. I think it's going to depend on the fact that the decision has emotional content is important.
Yeah.
But sometimes we want to deal with emotional issues in a creative way, in a more iterative, brainstorming way, and sometimes in an analytic way. My guess would be to follow the lead of Brock, for you to follow the lead of Charles and try it. Just try different methods. And I think this is a really, really important lesson here more broadly, in that we're reasonably good observers of other people's behavior, but we're terrible observers of our own behavior. And we need to recognize, just as you said earlier, Anne, that some people have this intuitive sense that, hey, I'm not the same at different times of the day. Well, the reason for that is that you're not the same at different times of the day. And so if you acknowledge that, observe that, and do something about it, As I said before, there is this pile of evidence showing that making better decisions about when to do things will improve your performance. It will improve your productivity, boost your creativity, and even increase your well-being.
I would love to get a hold of Amazon's records on when people do their online shopping.
Ah.
Wouldn't that be interesting?
I'm sure Amazon has that.
I'm sure they do. I think it would be very interesting to see when people just take – for some people, that's a break.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to go buy a shower curtain, whatever it might be.
Right.
Brock, thanks a lot for that question. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Bill and Troy, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a simple question regarding this, and would like to know if it has any effect or whether there's no effect at all in that regard. Our traditional cup of coffee in the morning, possibly energy drink, and sometimes at several times during the day. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
I guess in general, the reliance on drugs.
Yeah. Yeah, but the reliance on caffeine is not uniformly bad at all. But there's a timing aspect of this too, and there's some good research on this. So for instance, our instincts, those of us who are caffeine drinkers, I am one, coffee drinkers, our instinct is to have a cup of coffee first thing in the morning. And what we know from the science is that that's not ideal. What you should be doing instead is have a cup of coffee maybe 60 to 90 minutes after waking up. The reason for that is pretty simple. When we first wake up, we start producing cortisol. That's a stress hormone. And And that's what helps us wake up. So our cortisol levels, when we first wake up, start rising. It turns out that caffeine interferes with the production of cortisol. And so what you're better off doing is letting those cortisol levels peak, which takes about an hour. And then when they're declining, that's when you go in and boom, hit them with the caffeine. You're going to get more, you're going to get more bang for that. There's also this, we mentioned very briefly, napping. There's actually a really good napping technique that involves caffeine. It's a little
It's
a little counterintuitive. So there's a lot of research on naps, and naps are pretty good, actually. I like to think of, for all you Blue Jackets fans out there, naps are Zambonis for our brain, all right? So we've got, during the day, we have all these, like, nicks and scuffs on our mental ice, and like between the first and second period and second and third period, a Zamboni comes out and goes and smooths that all down. But the ideal nap is very, very short. It's about 10 to 20 minutes long. If you go longer than that, you begin to accumulate what's called sleep inertia, which is that groggy, boggy feeling we sometimes get. But there's a way to turbocharge even that short nap. So what you can do is you can what I do occasionally when I've when I haven't gotten enough sleep is I will take a nap in the afternoon. I will sit in a chair in my office. I will put on noise-canceling headphones. Then I'll have a cup of coffee. And that seems weird, so just stick with me on that. Then I'll have a cup of coffee. I'll set my timer on my phone for maybe 25 minutes. It takes me, let's say, 12 minutes to fall asleep. Then I get basically a 13-minute nap. That's right in the sweet spot. But here's the thing, back to the question about coffee and caffeine. It takes about 25 minutes for caffeine to get into your bloodstream. And so what you're – but see, if I have a cup of coffee before that nap, when I'm waking up from my short nap, I get all the restorative effects of the nap, no sleep inertia, and once again, boom, that added boost of caffeine for alertness. So even the timing of our caffeine intake can make a big role.
Huh, interesting.
And that's called, by the way, that technique is called a nappuccino.
A nappuccino. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Daniel Pink. He's author of a new book. He's a best-selling author. His new book is titled When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. If you have a question or comment for Daniel, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the importance of timing. We often ask what we should do or how we should do something, but a more important question might be when we should act or make decisions. Still with us is best-selling author Daniel Pink. His new book is titled When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. He will be at Bexley High School tonight. For more information, visit the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about exercise, Daniel? I know when I'd like to exercise, but unfortunately it conflicts with my job.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't do everything all the time. But what about exercise? How does it affect us?
Oh, I mean, exercise is one of those things that's just uniformly good for us. Mm-hmm. So anytime you can exercise is great. What the research on exercise tells us on time of day and exercise is that it depends on your goals. So if you want to lose weight, morning exercise is slightly better. If you want to form a habit, morning exercise seems slightly better. If you want to get a day-long mood boost, because exercise boosts our mood, morning exercise is definitely better. You exercise late in the day, you end up sleeping away some of that mood boost. However, afternoon exercise is good for other reasons. So if your goal is to avoid injury, definitely afternoon exercise. We have changes in body temperature over the day. We are literally more warmed up in the late afternoon and early evening. That's why we avoid injury. One reason I exercise later in the day, late in the afternoon or early in the evening is that I enjoy it more. And that's fairly common. People enjoy exercise more. They find it less effortful, probably because they're warmed up. Also, if you're really interested in performance and, you know, we're here in the shadow of the Ohio State Athletic Department, so I'm suddenly much more interested in performance.
True.
If you're interested in performance, there's a disproportionate number of records, world records, especially in speed events, speed skating, sprint swimming, sprinting, that occur between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. local time, probably because of this literally being more warmed up. So it depends on your goals.
Hmm. Will in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Will.
Yes. My question revolves, is very simple. The small and big time changes. We're going to do one this weekend for daylight saving time. And I've been in Europe and places where you go 6 hours, 7 hours, whatever. And how do you readjust safely and effectively and on this brand new schedule when you're really off and even an hour off?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there's actually a lot of research on daily savings time. And basically what it shows is that fall backward is generally pretty good for us. Spring ahead, which we're getting to, is generally not very good for us. For instance, there's a great piece of research that just came out about 6 months ago showing judges who made sentencing decisions on the Monday after spring ahead meted out sentences that were something like 7% harsher than on other Mondays of the year, probably because of sleep deprivation. There are more traffic accidents generally on the day after spring forward. There are more accidents in general because of the sleep deprivation. One of the things you can do is, and I think a generally useful guide, is set your clocks ahead Saturday early evening.
Hmm.
Start adjusting even before you go to sleep. That can play a marginal role. And try, if you can, to get enough sleep that night. And, you know, daylight savings time is actually fairly controversial. There are folks who are have been pushing in many places around the country to get rid of it altogether.
Guilty as charged.
Okay.
Will, thanks a lot for that call. What do we know about how deadlines affect us? I grew up in an industry, you know, in the newspaper business,
yeah,
where deadlines were everything. I guess I'm on a pretty tight deadline here. It's live radio, so.
Yeah. Deadlines have it depends on the kind of work you're doing. In general, deadlines are reasonably good. If you know what you need to be doing, so in the newspaper business, I have to write a 10-inch story about this legislator's decision. Deadlines are good. It'll get it done. If you were trying to figure out, I got to do a long series on something interesting, deadlines are not as good. So when it's a more kind of iterative, purely creative thing, deadlines actually don't help us. But for many, many things, deadlines do help us. And that's part of some of this research on endings, that endings, when we see an ending, we energize a little bit.
Okay.
That endings actually give us a little dose of motivation. This is a very sturdy finding in psychological science from the days of a guy named Clark Hull, who was, you know, racing rats down runways and seeing that the rats ran faster the closer they got to the food.
If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What about starting something new, project, whether it's renovating your bathroom or, you know, doing something at work? Does it matter?
It does, actually. There's some great research from Katie Milkman and Jason Reese at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, as well as Heng Chen Dai, who's now at UCLA. On the importance of what researchers call temporal landmarks. There are certain dates in the calendar that stand out in the way that physical landmarks stand out in space. And what these temporal landmarks do is they get us to slow down and pay attention. And some of these temporal landmarks also have the second effect, is that they trigger this peculiar form of mental accounting. So just as a business will open up a fresh ledger at the beginning of a new quarter, beginning of a new year, certain dates inspire us to do that mentally. So the most common one would be New Year's Day. That's why we have New Year's resolutions. But there are other dates that operate as what they call fresh start dates. So in a lot of research, they've shown that people are more likely to start a new diet, a new exercise regimen, a new work project on a Monday. And if you're more likely to start something, you're more likely to actually pull it off. If you never start it, you're obviously not going to accomplish it. And so if you're thinking about I got to move my diet, I got to try a new exercise regime, I have to renovate my bathroom, you're better off picking a temporal landmark, a fresh start date to do that. So do it on a Monday rather than on a Thursday. Do it on the first of the month rather than the 13th of the month. Or use a personal landmark. You're better off doing something like do it on the day after your birthday rather than 4 days before your birthday.
Huh. When it comes to the question of the good news, bad news question, you say that there's a good reason to start with one over the other. You know, the question of what do you want, the good news or the bad news first? Tell us what and why.
Well, you know, my instinct has always been to give the good news first just as a cushion. And that's wrong. When you ask people what they want to hear first, good news or bad news, overwhelmingly people want to hear the bad news first. And the reason for that is that we have this innate preference, it seems, for endings that with rising sequences rather than declining sequences. And this is why we have to be so watchful of how experiences, how encounters, how anything ends. Given a choice, human beings prefer endings that elevate. We prefer rising sequences to declining sequences. And so this is another area you said at the top of the show, Anne, how has this changed how you do things? I've totally changed my ways on this, that I am the king of giving the bad news first and then following with the good news.
Do you even give them a choice anymore?
No.
Okay. You talk about group timing and coordinating or synchronizing with team members. It's something we certainly do here.
Sure.
What does the research tell us about that?
There's some great stuff on there. To study that, I went to India, to Mumbai, India, to study these fellows called Dabbawalas who deliver lunches, 200,000 lunches a day in one of the most chaotic teeming cities on the planet. They do it without making any errors. They take lunches, homemade lunches from people's apartments to downtown Mumbai, 20 miles away, and not using any technology, using only the train system and bicycles and this elaborate written coding system. So FedEx has gone to study them. UPS has gone to study them. There's a Harvard Business School case study about them and trying to learn how do groups synchronize. And it turns out there's some rules. It's helpful to have a boss. It's helpful to have a sense of belonging. That's actually crucial to have a sense of belonging. And it's helpful to what I call synchronize to the heart, to have a sense of purpose and mission about it all. And the singing to the heart I got from studying the research on choral singing. We talked about exercise.
Choirs,
yeah.
Yeah.
The research on, okay, exercise, all good. Choral singing, all good. Choral singing is about as good for us as exercise. And even to the point where if you look at, there's an amazing amount of research on choral singing. Who knew?
Exactly.
Right. Second, it's fascinating. And so one of the things they found is that when people sing in choirs, their hearts, literally, I'm not talking metaphorical hearts, I'm talking about the organ in your chest here, begin beating in rhythm with each other, right? And then if you look at other research on choral singing, it's amazing. It's an incredible mood booster. It's a prophylactic against depression. It improves, amazingly, it improves our immune response. It raises our pain threshold. It makes people more likely to do good deeds. So there's something kind of magical when we coordinate in time with other people, suggesting that there's something about that activity of group synchronization that is profoundly, profoundly human, and that if we do more of it, we'll actually feel better and maybe even do better.
There's a choir in Columbus. It's called the Harmony Project, and it's huge now, and it's all about doing good deeds and that kind of a thing, and it makes people happy. And I'm just wondering if there's any kind of cast-off effect on the listeners, you know, the audience.
Oh, that's a great point.
And I love listening to Harmony.
Yeah. I don't know about that. My hunch would be that there would be some if the audience actually sang along.
Yeah. But
I don't know. Most of the research is on the
participants. Who are participants,
and it's especially good with kids. I mean, so it's any kind of synchronous activity. So choral singing, there's a lot of research, and it seems to be very robust. But even things like social dancing, other kinds of so there's some great research on kids where if you have two groups of kids, one plays a synchronous game. You know, clap and tap rhythmic game where they're in sync with everybody else. And then the others just play a game that's fun. The kids who've played the synchronous game afterwards are more likely to help the teacher, more likely to cooperate with their peers. Very interesting. More likely to be open to playing with kids who don't look like them. And so there's something about synchronizing that makes us feel good and do good. So the effects of that Harmony Project would have surprised me before I looked at this research. Now my view is, well, of course.
Yeah, it's interesting. But that literally that the hearts are beating in sync.
Literally.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is that – have they found that to be the case with the kids doing the games together?
I don't know. They haven't looked at that. There was actually a paper out earlier just last week showing that when – couples in a romantic relationship, when they hold hands, you have a synchronous physiological response from holding hands. What's interesting is that there are choirs out there that hold hands.
Yes.
And so I can't unpack this. I want to know what is going on. I don't know. But something's going on, and it's really interesting and profoundly human and helps us understand that timing plays such a powerful role in our lives and how we feel.
That makes me wonder about all kinds of things, like when we hug each other goodbye in the morning, you know, with our family members and that kind of a thing. What happens at that moment and what's happening and why?
I don't know this material all that well, but you know, there's this hormone oxytocin that we consider the quote unquote love hormone, and so that ends up being produced for things like physical contact with people you care about. So a hug probably releases some amount of oxytocin and makes you feel a little bit better.
Huh. For a couple years in the 90s, you worked as chief speechwriter for Al Gore.
A long time ago,
president.
Yes, indeed.
Seems like, yeah, it was a long time ago. But if you knew everything you know now then, how would that have changed how you did that kind of a job?
I probably would have done fewer all-nighters, which I sadly
had. You probably reveled in at the time.
There were moments when I reveled in it. There were moments when I railed against it. I probably would have been more deliberate about taking breaks more than anything else, because in that kind of hothouse environment, there's it's a culture of powering through. It's a culture of always on. And I think in those kinds of settings, people can make mistakes. I'm surprised that we didn't make more mistakes than we actually did.
And then when it comes to personal romantic relationships, that kind of thing, there's research on timing, just how to get married and when to get married.
Well, yeah, there's research showing that.
Is it done by the wedding industries?
Right. Well, actually, there's one piece of research the wedding industry will hate. But there's research from Nick Wolfinger at University of Utah showing, just looking at broad populations and showing that it's all heterosexual couples who get married between 25 and 32, that seems to be the sweet spot for a marriage lasting. Now, again, if you get married at 33, it doesn't mean you're going to get divorced. If you get married at 43, it doesn't mean you're going to get divorced. But it seems like there's an age sweet spot there. The thing the wedding industry will not like is that there's research out of Emory University showing an inverse relationship between how much a couple spends on their wedding or an engagement ring and the likelihood of the marriage succeeding. That is, the more you spend on your wedding, the more you spend on the engagement ring, the less likely it is that a marriage will succeed.
But it's just correlation at this point.
Exactly.
We don't know why.
We can speculate why. And it's always fun to speculate why, but it's just correlation. You're
but
exactly
no,
right.
no, on the timing of the wedding, what month of the year, that kind of a thing.
I don't think there's anything on time of day or interesting on month of the year. There is some research on divorce filings in month of the year.
Yeah,
it turns out there are 2 months every year where divorce filings spike considerably. It's a huge, huge effect, and so those months are August and also this month, March.
Huh. But we don't know why.
Well, I think we can have a very strong hypothesis why.
Okay.
So most couples who are struggling try to keep it together during the winter holidays.
Okay.
Into the new year. Divorce filings go way down in December, and it's a holiday time, it's a family time. People try to keep it together. Then maybe they come out of the new year and it's like, okay, this thing is doomed. And so this is the measure that they have is divorce filings. So you realize in January that it's doomed. You start talking to the lawyer and you eventually make your filing in March. Same thing is true in
get
August.
Get through the summer vacation.
Get the kids through the school year.
Daniel Pink, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Daniel Pink is the author of a new book. It's titled when. The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. He'll be holding an author talk tonight at Bexley High School. For more information, go to WOSU.org/AllSides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, All Sides interns Michael Lee, Alexander Havalchik, and Martin Coleman, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.